Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
When I say kids, what image springs to your mind? Beloved sons, daughters or grandchildren? Noisy, grubby little people? Annoyances in the supermarket? The cute, sassy kids of Hollywood movies? Memories, perhaps, of your own childhood? My next guest has a long history with children. As CEO of Compassion, he's travelled the world over, seeing children in all sorts of circumstances, often extraordinarily difficult situations. He's seen children starving, disease-ridden and homeless. Now, instead of travelling, he is writing, not about third world children living in dirt, poverty and disaster, but the children of Australia, the so-called lucky country. His most recent publication is a book with the very confronting, provocative title, Why Satan Hates Our Children. I'm really interested in the title of his book, but first, let's explore the kids in the lucky country with Paul O'Rourke. Paul, welcome to Open House.
Thanks, Lee. Good to be here.
Thanks for coming in. I really want to explore what you mean by that title. It is very provocative in a moment, but why, with all of that experience around the world that you've had, why kids in Australia?
Good question. Really comes back to 2007, November the 8th, catching a plane back from the US, picked up a copy of the Australian newspaper, and the lead story was about a seven-year-old girl who died of starvation just north of Newcastle at Hawk's Nest. In the body of that story, well, firstly, 7 years old, she weighed 9 kilos, about the size of a one-year-old. Yeah. When she died. You know, so my first thought was, how does this happen in a country like Australia where we really want for nothing? In the body of that story, it mentioned another child whose name we didn't know for a little while. He was just the boy in the suitcase, a little two-year-old who had been murdered, put into a suitcase and thrown into a suburban dam. Mm. We learned his name later as Dean Shillingsworth. Yeah. Same paper, same day. The little girl dying of starvation wasn't actually the lead story. The lead story in the left-hand column was actually about police breaking an international child pedophile ring and making dozens of arrests in Australia, including a grandfather who was abusing his own child in real time. I just started some studies in child development, and they'd insisted that we choose our own culture for our assignments, and suddenly I just came face to face with the real need that was in our own backyard.
So you were shocked, clearly, that this could happen in the so-called lucky country.
I was shocked that it could happen, but more shocked by the prevalence of what's happening to our kids and the enormity of the problem, if you like, that faces Australians. That's what shocked me most.
So the more you looked at it, the worse the problem seemed.
Exactly, and as I said, it got to the point where I was so shocked and concerned at the breadth of it that I simply felt compelled to write a book to let other people know that things are not well for children in the lucky country.
And just to put it into perspective, tell us about some of the things you have seen around the world with kids in other terrible trouble.
Well, I figured out I'd been probably on 50 or 60 overseas trips to developing countries. And, you know, you're talking about extreme poverty. You're talking about children who lack all the basic necessities, food, clothing, healthcare, education, etc. You know, children that, you know, the stereotypical child standing in front of the mud hut in Africa or living in a slum in the Philippines. And children who really have no hope unless there's some really radical intervention. And it, you know, breaks your heart every time you see it because, you know, there's thousands, tens of thousands of children.
Again, as I said, notwithstanding all of that, you focus on Australian kids. What's your conclusion about why these times for kids in Australia can be so difficult?
The reason I've focused on children in Australia is because I think people are unaware of the extent of the problem. So the child in Africa is now well known, and people like Bono and Oprah have helped, and even, you know, live, going right back to Live Aid and Bob Geldof, people are pretty much aware of the needs of children in the developing world.
Yes.
But the children in Australia who are suffering live in middle-class homes, they wear designer clothes, they don't kind of look in need, and That's why I wanted to draw attention to
it. How do you say they are suffering, notwithstanding what appears to be a good existence in a good country?
Well, I think they're suffering spiritually, socially, emotionally and spiritually, and physically on occasion. But it's really a poverty of spirit, if you like. So what I mean by that is many Australian children have everything to live with, but nothing to live for. We have a huge youth suicide problem. We know children are more anxious than any other time in history. That doesn't seem to go well with our standard of living in Australia. There's a disconnect, if you like.
So why is that happening in families, or is the family thing part of the problem that so many families are so disrupted in so many ways these days?
Absolutely. You can trace it all back to the breakdown of relationship. You know, when relationships fail, children suffer. And so more and more divorces, more and more people cohabitating. So, you know, temporary transient relationships where children go from one family formation to another is disruptive, and it has serious implications for our children.
How do you say that practically plays out, the consequences of that plays out in the lives of these kids?
Well, they lack role models, they lack consistency, they're not quite sure where they belong, because sometimes in all the shuffling and the fighting, they are pawns in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So that affects their self-esteem. Where they're not getting the attention and the nurture and the love that they need, they go looking for it elsewhere. So promiscuity, binge drinking, drug problems, etc. It manifests in dozens of ways.
I've spoken to quite a few experts in my time, even already on Open House, who say perhaps the number one issue Australia faces is not climate change or the other stuff we hear about in the media each day, but the number one issue is how to help parents become better at parenting.
You've hit it in one. Absolutely. That is the core problem.
So why isn't it done, do you think?
You've kind of answered your own question in saying we seem so obsessed with climate change and carbon taxes and issues that really aren't scratching where people itch. That hidden problem of family breakdown has been largely ignored. You know, through some of the work that I've been doing, we're trying to bring that to the attention of the government and opposition so that policy starts to change, and this whole issue of couples relationship training and parent-child training actually gets on the front foot.
Is it a lack of courage on the part of our political leaders?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's a really lack of knowing what to do. And through some of the work I've done through a research report through the Australian Christian Lobby, we're actually trying to answer that question for government. We know that just giving more in parenting allowances, while that helps, that's addressing the symptoms, not the core problem, not the cause.
But underlying any approach to parenting, whatever you're going to teach them, has to be a certain framework of values or ethic? Do you think they're afraid of committing themselves to anything that might smack of values?
No, I don't. I think that the recommendations that we've made to the government is very much aware of the different types of families, single parents, same-sex families. They all have their own specific problems and they all need to address those in specific ways. But no, I don't think it is concerned by the government about values.
Okay. I put in front of you two parents at the start of their family life. What are the things that you would say to them about how to do that job well or better than we're doing at the moment?
We know that children do well when their parents are married. Sounds old-fashioned, not very popular,
yeah,
but lots and lots of studies confirm that over and over again. So to me, it's if you're going to have children, you need to be in a committed relationship, and you need to realise that children need that consistency, they need that nurturing and love, they need boundaries, they need time, not just things to play with, but values to live by. They need to know that they're loved unconditionally.
On the question of marriage, is the rush to de facto relationships part of the problem?
Absolutely, because we know that de facto and, you know, those types of relationships are much more temporary. They break up far more often, And so we've actually got now the number of children who are growing up, reach the age of 15 in a family that's not intact, the original mum, dad, has doubled in the past decade. And you can see that a number of other problems have corresponded with that very fact. That's not saying that no cohabitating couple or de facto couple or, you know, other types of relationships can't provide good care and great children, but it certainly makes it harder.
That's where I wonder whether it's a courage problem on the part of the politicians, because which politician is going to be seen to be criticising de facto couples?
Mm. I don't think it's a matter of criticising de facto couples. I think it's a matter of training them on, if you like, the outcomes and some of the consequences of the choice of that lifestyle. So being aware of it going into it, and so when they choose to have children, to do it knowingly and doing it intentionally, and then providing support so they actually get parenting training. You can't drive a car without a license. You can't get a license without hundreds of hours of training, but we let anyone have a child, and there's not the support mechanisms there used to be on how to parent.
But it is more complicated than just saying to a de facto couple, you should be married.
Oh, of course, that's not the answer. The answer is how to be great parents.
Mm. We're speaking with Paul O'Rourke. He's the author of this confronting book, Why Satan Hates Our Kids, which we'll get to in a moment. Let's get back to the poverty issue, Paul. We're in such a lucky country, a rich country. It does seem almost impossible to believe the reality that many, many children are living in poverty here.
Yes, it does, but it is true, and there are a number of causes for that. Some of it is debt, so poorer families getting themselves, or not even poorer families, some middle-class families getting themselves into debt, which plunges them into poverty, which puts stress on the family. Some of it's also alcohol and drug addiction, which means they can't supply what's needed for the family, and so, you know, children suffer. It's also dangerous domestic situations where children run away or are kicked out of home simply because they're not wanted and it's not safe there. So there's a number of myriad of problems that results in children living in poverty.
What part does education play in helping people, parents and kids, out of the poverty cycle?
Well, we know, you know, education's vital in any society to children and families doing well, but you mentioned earlier about parenting. I think it does come back to skills on how to parent. We're not very good at managing conflict. And then there are stresses on top of that, and parents and families just disintegrate. So to me, it's all about almost, you know, families at risk, mentoring them in a way where it's holistic, where you address the physical, the emotional, the relational issues that plunge people into poverty.
The modern mood is very much looking inward to myself and my own interests, and yet it seems to me that good parenting would be the exact opposite, looking out.
Oh, exactly.
For the benefit of those kids.
Yeah, that's right. Children are not a fashion accessory. They're not consumers.
Yes.
They are on loan to us. We don't own them. But with a child comes great joy, but also a responsibility that this is my primary job to be a carer for the next generation. And what a greater job could there be?
Too right. What greater challenge? So how do you train people to be more outward looking rather than looking after number one?
Well, I believe it's about making people fall in love again with children. We're very hypocritical and inconsistent in our attitudes towards children. We're having fewer children, we're having them later in life. They're growing up in an aging population where people aren't very tolerant of children. And you know, one of my desire in writing the book is actually to get people to see children for who they are, the incredible value that they have, not for when they grow up, but as little children, their innocence, their love, their acceptance, their purity. All the things that make children great, we need to rediscover those. And as you said, that means taking our eyes off ourselves and being far less selfish and more about sowing into the next generation.
You also deal in your book with abortion. What have you found about the cost of that to Australia, of the abortions which are performed each year?
Most Australians are unaware that there are somewhere between 80 and 100,000 abortions every year in this country. So that's a staggering number. I say estimated because we don't actually count them. I can tell you with more certainty how many new cars will be sold this calendar year than how many children are aborted. But we know that that abortion obviously is terminating a life. But it also wounds a woman. We don't hear much about that, about the effects of abortion and how that how many women grieve, how they feel guilt and shame as a result of that. Because while it's legal, morally, nobody celebrates abortion. It's done in secret. It's done quietly. It's done in ways that ultimately leave a woman wounded. And that has great cost on our society ultimately. But we need to decide where we stand as a society. What do we value? What are the not negotiables? And surely a child's right to life is as important as a woman's right.
Yeah. Paul, what can churches do you think, to better care for families, better care for kids?
Well, I think they need to certainly firstly be aware. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book. The second then is once you're aware, you have a responsibility to do something. And there's hundreds of things that you can do. And, you know, many churches are already doing it. To me, it's about linking those churches with some other great programs that are already running. Christians Against Poverty, helping families get out of debt, helping single mums, providing vocational training, providing food and stuff at schools, you know, breakfast clubs, counselling for women with unplanned pregnancies. One of the key reasons why women feel they don't have a choice and have abortions is because they think they can't afford it or they can't cope. Well, why not come alongside them and show them that they can, providing practical support so they can continue their pregnancy.
With love and acceptance rather than judgment.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not about judgment at all. It's about loving the mother and saying, you know, you can do it and we're there to help you.
So that takes us to the title of your book. Why did you call it Why Satan Hates Our Kids?
We'll come right back to your first question that I answered by talking about that little girl who's starved in Hawk's Nest.
Yes.
And the pedophile ring that the police broke, in that we might not be able to give a definition of evil, but we all know it when we see it. There are crimes that are just so horrific, they're so against cultural and societal standards that it's evil. Now, whether you call it Satan or the devil or whatever, that doesn't really matter. But I'm simply saying that there is a battle, there is a spiritual battle over our children. And it really comes back to that good versus evil. And there is an enemy, and as I said, call him whatever you will. But to me, it's Satan. It's an enemy of life. And trying to steal and kill and destroy our families, our children, our relationships.
To some, it might sound freaky or spooky. What would you say to them?
Well, just look at the facts. Don't let that be the problem. But as I said, I think we all recognise some things are just inherently evil.
Yes.
And, you know, as I said, whether you call it Satan or not doesn't really matter. But simply look at the facts and say, you know, can we really be that bad just on our own? Some of it is just so extraordinarily bad that there has to be a spiritual cause as well.
Important questions to be confronted and considered. Paul O'Rourke, it's a very absorbing read, challenging and confronting, but important. Thanks so much for joining us on
Thanks,
Open House.
Thanks, Lee. Great to be with you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.